And it is today's Topical Currents, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon. Well, this hour we begin with the CEO of the Council of Ethical Organizations. He's Mark Pastin. He's an award-winning ethics researcher, advisor, consultant, and speaker. And he's written the book, Make an Ethical Difference, Tools for Better Action. And he joins us from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to you, Mark Pastin.
Thank you.
Could you speak up a little bit, Mark?
Sure.
There we go.
Okay, good to have you with us. Good afternoon.
Thanks.
So you say we all have this ethics eye. What is that? Could you explain?
It's a sense that of what is right and what is wrong. And, you know, that sometimes seems implausible to people, given some of the schemes and scams that we hear about. But it's like any other sense in that if you want it to work, you have to learn how to use it, and you have to have confidence that if you do use it, you will improve your ability to see right and wrong.
So it's not learned ethical behavior. It's not learned. It's not a personality trait. It's innate.
Well, I think it's kind of like anything. If you're looking at aesthetic sense, you know, the idea that some, let's say, pictures are better looking than others, right? Is it a learned trait or is it an acquired one? Well, we have the sense of vision. We're born with it. But in order to use that vision to evaluate art, it requires a good deal of training. So, like any other sense, the raw material of the sense is born with us, but whether we do anything with that raw material depends entirely on us.
Mark Pastin, you're in the Washington, D.C. area, which sort of leads the league, probably, in ethics violations. We're here in South Florida, which probably is at least in the first division. What happens when you're You operate so much out of a culture of corruptions and poor ethics?
Well, I mean, cultures of corruption do exist, certainly in various places in the world and certainly in parts of our government, but you can't use the fact that the culture is a certain way as a reason to do something unethical yourself. And people often have the attitude, well, what can you expect given the culture that exists, for example, say in Washington, D.C.? Well, what you can expect is that people use their ethics sense and resist what that culture is encouraging. The culture doesn't make you do it.
You say you want to sharpen people's innate ability to reason ethically and to influence others in the workplace, but is ethics reasoning really innate? Are we born with that?
As I said, we're born with the abilities that make up the ethics sense, and it's up to us whether we sharpen them. Just to give you an example, one of the human traits that's important to good ethical judgment is the ability to be in sympathy with others, so that if something bad happens to that other person, to some extent, you feel what they're feeling, or at least something like what they're feeling. Another part of the ethics sense is the ability to be in empathy with others, which means to see the world as others see it. It's a different sense than sympathy. The ability to sympathize and empathize are built in. They're wired in. What do we do with them? Well, that's the area where some sharpening, some training, some education, some experimentation will lead people to better ethical judgment.
I assume you're omitting the likes of sociopaths or psychopaths, those that don't have empathy and sympathy. We're just talking about most people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we talk about somebody who's a sociopath, we view them as deficient in some basic human traits.
Right.
And the fact that we view them as deficient in those traits suggests they really are basic human traits. It's you know, kind of like if you took the sense of balance, if somebody was born without the sense of balance and didn't learn to use their balance, we would regard them as deficient because the sense of balance comes wired in, or at least the potential to have a sense of balance. I mean, anyone who's ever watched an infant kind of working their way around on their hands and knees and trying to stand up knows that although that infant was born with a sense of balance, learning to use it takes some work.
Mm-hmm.
What's surprising is we don't do much of that work in ethics. We're just kind of like the baby there trying to stand on his own two feet and falling down.
Tell us about the role of an ethics advisor, and how do you know your advice is wanted, or is it just a PR window dressing to mitigate criticism?
Well, let me answer your question. Yeah, yes. Sometimes it's window dressing, sometimes it's substantive, sometimes it's some combination of both. A concern about reputation is not a bad thing, certainly, and a lot of times an organization will reach out because they're concerned about their reputation.
And hold a press conference and say, we're moving forward.
Correct. Yes. We see the problem. We're moving forward. You know, as an ethics advisor, you're kind of in a constant state of negotiation with the organization in terms of whether they make the substantive changes that are required or whether they just talk about it. If they do make the changes, then they're certainly entitled to talk about the changes that they've made.
You can't.
So it's a little bit of both, is the truth.
Okay. Of course, you can't blame anyone else for your own ethical or unethical behavior, but you say that executives set the ethical tone at their companies, but employees have the power to improve it. That sounds like a tall order to me. Could you give us an example of how one could do that?
Well, I think the way to do it is if you're an employee and you're not in a position of great influence in the organization,
right,
try to change the part of the organization where you are an influence. In other words, instead of trying to change the whole organization, change the place where you work and the culture in that workplace. If the culture is bad, then improving it in one place is better than improving it no place. Now, I think if you want to put the issue in broader perspective, will individuals working to change the ethics of their individual workplace, will they influence the culture of the organization? And I think the answer is yes, it will, but it won't influence it critically if leadership won't set the tone.
Right.
Perhaps you've, Mark Paston, followed, I know you wouldn't know the ins and outs, but the Miami Dolphins bullying scandal.
Yep.
How would you apply your principles to that situation where management kind of stonewalled, not the owner, but there was some of the coaches were involved in that? And
yeah, well, I don't know a great deal about that situation. Obviously, bullying, the idea that bullying is acceptable is sort of a textbook example of how the ethics sense is growth is stunted. And if you think about that, remember we said the ethics sense involves sympathy and empathy. Well, if you have somebody who is gay and they're different from you, you can't turn off your sympathy and empathy. If you're bullying them, you're still bullying a human being, and you need to be able to both sympathize with the wrong done to them and to empathize with the world as they see it. So certainly that kind of bullying is a textbook violation of ethics. Now, what you're asking is a very, very interesting point. One is, did management condone this, or did they turn a blind eye to it? And I don't know enough to know the answer to that. But, you know, certainly turning a blind eye to it is to condone it.
You mentioned four ethical types. You say the conformist, the negotiator, the navigator, and the wiggler. But isn't the navigator the only real one who's ethical? It sounds like the other three are...
You know, yeah. I don't think it really generally makes sense to say a person is ethical or a person isn't ethical. People can be ethical in different domains of their life as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people are very ethical in their role as parent, but not very ethical in their role as manager at work. We tend to be, our ethics tend to be specific to situations and types of problems. The people most likely to be ethical in any domain are the ones that we call navigators, and that is, they're people who not only know the rules and respect and understand the rules, but they know how to influence others to know the rules and to respect them. So being ethical, you know, if you sit in a room by yourself all your life, you're not doing something to make you ethical. Ethical is being ethical is about making things better. It's about doing the right thing.
Right. Well, it's about making choices.
Yes.
We're speaking with Mark Paston. He's an award-winning ethics thought leader, consultant, speaker, and writer. His book is entitled Make an Ethical Difference, Tools for Better Action. It's Topical Currents. We'll come back and take some calls and emails. Stay with us.
And we return, Thursday edition, Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and the CEO of the Council of Ethical Organizations, Mark Paston. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, you're welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email at radio@WLRN.org. Mark Paston, I was reading about that you have this terrific acclaim in Japan, where you spoke to a single audience of 10,000. Are you sort of the rock star ethicist?
Well, I was invited to speak to that group. They were students graduating from a chain of colleges and universities across the country, and I think I was selected based on the book I wrote before the current book, which sold well in Japan, which surprised me. It was also a book about ethics, and people don't really think that the business community in Japan has a lively sense of ethics, but the book sold and the people came to hear, and so there's at least a population there about which the stereotype is false.
Hmm. Well, you talk about these five tools for sharpening our own ethics, and we can apply them to any ethical problem. So why don't we go over them?
That would be fine. Do you want me to go over them?
Yes, please.
Please stop me because it is five different tools.
Okay, the thumbnail versions.
I know. Well, the first one is know the ground rules, and that has to do with what ethics really is, and what ethics really is are the basic rules that a person or an organization follows in their actions, as opposed to in their words.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to know somebody's ethics, you look at the rules that govern their action, not necessarily what they say. So the first thing is to know your own ground rules, to know your principles, and they may be different than what you say, and the same goes for learning the ground rules of others. The second important rule is simply, before you make an ethical judgment, be sure that you have the facts related to that judgment. Sometimes an ethical disagreement exists not because there's a real difference in principles amongst the individuals, but because there is a disagreement over facts. A third tool is learn the interests that are in the situation. The interests are the driving force behind human behavior. They're also the driving force behind ethical or unethical conduct. And it's important to know what interests are at play in a situation in order to make a good judgment in that situation. Another tool is, we call it simply standing in the shoes of the people affected by your actions. In other words, when you're thinking of doing something, put yourself in the position of the other people who will be affected by your action. And finally, there is measure the benefits against the costs. Not that that's a firm and final rule, but you should think about what you're doing in terms of the long-term consequences, both benefit and harm. So that's the thumbnail sketch of the five principles.
Okay.
And why don't we take one of the ethical dilemmas in your book? You have 12 of them, I think, or something like that. But why don't we take one of them and use your approach to resolve it? Whether, okay. Should we take the yogurt?
The Greek yogurt?
Yeah, well, as it turns out, yogurt has become more ethically controversial than one would have ever imagined when I wrote that example. Because, of course, the controversy that now exists over Whole Foods.
Right.
And discontinuing Chobani because they claim that there are genetically modified or altered components to it. And then you see Chobani at the Olympics saying, the way it's made matters. So they're trying to answer that back. They don't want there to be a groundswell of opinion that the product isn't wholesome or pure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of battle going on over yogurt right now, and I hadn't anticipated that. But, you know, the whole area, the whole fad of Greek yogurt started out slow, and then it exploded. And the companies that were purveyors of Greek yogurt were small companies in a world of Unilevers and, you know, gigantic consumer companies.
You mean like Faya? Like Faya?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the question was, one of the things about Greek yogurt is it came in a container that was bigger than the containers that most yogurt is in. And if you've watched over the years, yogurt containers have become smaller and smaller and smaller. And now if you dip a teaspoon in twice, you've probably finished it off. And, you know, the hope of the companies has been that they can charge the same price while keep making the portion smaller, and while they're at it, bragging that there's fewer and fewer calories simply because you get less.
Mm-hmm.
So now the question is, how are we going to compete with these Greek yogurt companies, and what are we going to do? And so the question really is, do we match them container size for container size, or do we continue our strategy of making our product a little bit, in quotes, less fattening by making the portions smaller? Or are we going to meet this challenge head on?
Okay.
So
let's use your tools to resolve it.
Okay. Well, I think, the first thing you want to look at in this situation is the interests of the parties involved. Whether the mainstream companies will match the container size of the Greek companies depends on their sense of how consumers will respond or how they will react, and what the consumer's interest in this is. And by whittling their portion size down to a fractional part of what it once was, they seem not to have lost the confidence of consumers. Now they're wondering if there is someone in the market with larger portions, will the consumers still be interested in our price and in our brand and our claims, or will they be interested in something different and which has different advantages over our product? So certainly you're trying to figure out the interests of consumers and whether or not consumers will follow those interests. I think the ground rules at issue here are very interesting in that, this downsizing of products has been really a bane of the retail economy now for the past 10 years or more. And the ground rule is, that the people are following is if you can get away with downsizing it, do it.
Right.
Mark Paston, could we move on to something else? We only have a little bit of time left, but I'd like
to
touch on this. What if you're forced to go with the flow working for an unethical organization just to keep your family fed and also keep your medical benefits active? How can you resolve that other than maybe tossing and turning at night?
Well, it's a difficult situation to be in, but I believe that if you look at the organization you're in, you'll find at least some areas where you can have a positive influence, despite the fact that maybe the organization is not doing the right thing. But the other obligation you have is to not just accept the status quo, but to look for alternatives where you could work and where you could maintain your ethics. So I'm not advising that you just walk away from your job and say good luck to your family, but on the other hand, if you recognize that the company is unethical, then the minimum obligation you have is to try to change it. And if you can't change it or it's not realistic to try to change it, then at least try to limit your behavior, which falls into the category of unethical, by finding some place to work that's better.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us today. Mark Paston is an award-winning ethics thought leader, consultant, speaker, and writer, and the CEO of the Council of Ethical Organizations, and that's a nonprofit dedicated to promoting ethics in business and government. Make an Ethical Difference, Tools for Better Action, and your website is markpaston.com. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay,
well,
thanks for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk to all of you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Food and Dining is next. And it is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And it's Food and Dining Thursday, hooray. With us now is Cordon Bleu chef, author, syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. She's famous for her weekly Dinner in Minutes columns. So what's on the menu today?
Well, thank you for that.
I thought I'd kind of do a little different open for you. It was getting kind of old.
I see. Nice to be with you, Joe and Bonnie.
Thank you.
Nice to be with
thank
you.
Thank you. You too, Linda.
Okay, hospitality is on the menu today. It's a major industry in South Florida. It's an ever-changing field. Florida International University that we have right here in Florida, South Florida, is the forefront of the new ideas and training for the industry. And here to fill us in on the new changes is Dean Mike Hampton. He's the Dean of the Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at FIU. Welcome, Dean.
Good afternoon. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you with us. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for our guest about hospitality here in South Florida? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Our email is radio@WLRN.org.
And with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read his wine column. It's on the front page of today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Hi, guys. Well, I think I would like to ask Dean Hampton some questions about FIU's research into wine. They're doing some very exciting stuff.
Well, okay. I think he might have some answers for you.
And we do.
And he does. Okay, Dean Mike Hampton, hospitality, there's new horizons ahead. How is it transforming?
Well, there are so many things that we could talk about to answer that question, Linda. The world is changing in all kinds of ways, and it's particularly impacting what's going on in hospitality and tourism. In our discussion from an academic viewpoint, we're really starting to look more at the science, technology, engineering, and math components that go into hospitality, and who would have ever thought that that would be part of the discussion?
Science in hospitality. Okay.
Math.
Absolutely.
We need some
explanations.
Well,
that'll let me out right away.
Give us a little explanation about what you mean.
Yeah. When we look at the kinds of things that we eat or we drink or the kinds of experiences we have when we stay in a resort, all of it is by design. And so what we're teaching from a management standpoint is how do we engineer the kinds of things that guests are going to experience whenever they go out to dine or whenever they're going to have a beer at a local pub.
What does that mean? You're engineering my thinking?
Absolutely we are, because we want to
influence that.
No, you should be very proud of that, because what we do is we ensure that guests' experiences are the best that they can be. So we're thinking critically about that these days. We don't want things to happen by chance.
Well, so let me ask you a few questions then.
Sure.
How is your new generation of students adapting to all of this science, math, technology?
Actually, they're embracing it with enthusiasm.
Maybe they're teaching you.
There we go. You know, we're learning a lot from the students as well as they from us. We just looked, and we have 37% of our undergraduate students that are international, and 65% of our students that are graduate students come from abroad. And what that tells us is that globalization isn't coming. It's already here. And so the students from around the world are eager to learn what are we doing here in the U.S. And we have this millennial generation that thinks about things completely different than anyone ever has before. So we're designing curriculum and learning experiences that adapt to that younger generation and preparing graduates to go to work for the global companies.
So, well, what I'm thinking when you're talking about science, you know, I think about molecular gastronomy or things like that. And I don't think that's what you mean here, because you're a hospitality management school and you're not a culinary school.
Right.
So what are you talking about when you're talking about science?
Well, we're talking about making sure that people understand how we yield the kinds of things that are going to fit into our supply chain management. If we're going to operate a restaurant, we have to know that we're going to be able to get the kinds of products that fit within our menu. Right. So when we're teaching the management side of that, how do they get, if we're talking farm to table, how do they get the right kinds of products in sufficient quantities to be able to produce the menus that they're expecting?
And so is that all computerized?
Oh, no, not necessarily.
We use
computers and technology to help us with that.
Uh-huh.
We're doing a lot of predictive analytics to look at what crop productions for the future might be so that they're thinking about these kinds of things.
So I mean, this is something that we as consumers, I never think about that. I go to the restaurant, I order food. I don't think about the fact that perhaps we're not growing enough food that's going to supply that particular meat for the world.
Absolutely. And that's a big concern, not just for the restaurant industry, but anyone in food service or in beverages. We have to make sure that we're planning and being effective, because there's so many factors that impact production and then the ability to get what we need.
Wow, that's a big part. That's a big lot to learn. Okay, but you mentioned hospitality. It's a global community, and you have a school in China.
Yes, we do.
So why did you pick China for an FIU school?
Well, that was a very strategic move for us, because if you look at the growth of hospitality and tourism worldwide, the greatest concentration of developers is happening in Asia. And China certainly is the big gorilla in the room. And we felt that we wanted to be the leader that gets established there to help, and the Western companies that are developing operations over there, to have a stream of talent that can help them in operating.
So these are all Chinese students who are there?
Well, it's a combination, because it's an FIU campus. We have both students from our Miami program that go there on study abroad, and they'll spend a semester or maybe even a year.
What about the teachers? Are the classes taught in English or Chinese or both?
No, everything is in English. It's exactly the same as our program here in Miami. But we hire some Chinese faculty that all have the same qualifications as our faculty right here. And we have some of our American faculty that are over there teaching.
So this is to create or supply hospitality students for Asia?
Absolutely. In fact, as a good example, Jamie Oliver is opening a series of his new Jamie's Italian restaurants all across Asia. And he's partnered with FIU to be able to help him in supplying the management talent.
That is amazing, isn't it?
Really? How large is the school there? How many students?
We have 1,100 students at the Tianjin campus. It's a big operation for us. And we have, in comparison, we have 2,500 students here in North Miami.
Wow. And I think it's amazing that you have students from all over the world coming into here to FIU.
Well, when you do something well, people from around the world really want to know how to do it right. And we've established an excellent program that attracts that kind of attention. So we're very fortunate.
Speaking from the person who established the program.
Yes.
But it is good. I know I've had some FIU students helping me, and they've been just a pleasure to work with.
So
I have to say that.
We're very proud of them.
Okay. So now you have an amazing dining room that's there, looking right on the bay.
Oh, you know, and I'm going to look at you with a stern look because it's a restaurant management lab. A lot of people have said, oh, you have a new restaurant. Well, it's not open to the public for general consumption. It's teaching facility.
And so we're going to eat out of beakers?
Well, yeah, in Petri dishes. We make that a point. No, it's actually a fine dining facility that's simulated so that students can go in and practice the management techniques, looking at how they can improve efficiencies, how they might incubate new ideas for restaurant concepts. They can look at the integration of technology and how they perform the management operations. So it's really a learning facility.
Wouldn't it help to open it as a fine dining facility and have the public being able to take advantage of that?
Absolutely. And what the students do in a course is that they will offer four different simulated dining experiences.
Wait, simulated? That means we don't get food?
You do get food, yes.
But
it's a practice exercise because our students, as you pointed out earlier, are not culinarians. So they really don't know how to cook. They're not here to learn how to cook, but learn how to manage culinary operations. So they practice cooking under the guidance of our culinary faculty. So they do produce food items, but at the same time, the class splits up and a group will work on the marketing, a group will work on the financial side, a group will work on the operations and logistics side, purchasing and receiving. So the students get exposure to all aspects. So they have to be servers. Although when they graduate, they won't be.
Mm-hmm. How about customer relations?
Oh, absolutely. We have greeters and we have a general manager that takes charge of how do we make sure we interact correctly with the students.
So do you have a virtual unsatisfied customer?
We certainly, they aren't virtual. we have real guests that come in. They can buy the tickets and
what Bonnie's asking is that the public can come.
Sure.
Is it open? Not all the time. So if we wanted to go there, how would we do that?
It's scheduled. On the hospitality website, you can go in and see what the dates are that are available for people to come
in. Okay. And what's the website?
It's hospitality.fiu.edu.
Okay.
And I'm noticing here on the brochure that you've given me, it's $20.
Isn't that a bargain?
For dinner?
Yes.
It's a three-course meal. And it is spectacular, I can tell you. Our culinary faculty ensure that the meal comes out right. No disasters.
Fred's not on yet, but I'm going to ask for him.
Okay.
Do you serve wine?
We do. In fact, our wine program and our beer program both produce product that we serve to our guests as well. We also produce carbonated beverages.
I've been to a couple of wine tastings there, and they're really fabulous.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right, so not only that, Bonnie, the facility is right on the water. It's a beautiful spot.
Is it the one in North Miami, Biscayne
yes.
Bay?
Yes.
So it's Biscayne Bay.
Yes. So you have views of Olita State Park, the harbor where we have all the sailboats, and then you look across to Bell Harbor. Spectacular views.
Not bad for $20 and a three-course meal. So go on the website to see where it is. Well, we're going to go for a break now. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking with FIU Dean Mike Hampton about the changing hospitality world. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We've been talking with Dean Mike Hampton. He's the Dean of the Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at FIU. And hospitality is an important economic force in South Florida. He's been telling us about the changes and how FIU is adapting to them. Lots and lots of information there. But right now, it's dinner and minutes time. And in case you haven't heard, there's a big food festival going on now in South Beach. It's the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. And there's a burger bash going on. So if you're thinking burgers, I thought, well, maybe we'll have a dinner in minutes burger. It's a quick burger, but it has an extra kick. And it's a Texas tuna burger with jalapeno mayonnaise. So you just chop some jalapenos, peppers, do it in the food processor, and mix them with a little mayonnaise. That's easy enough. And then remove the mayonnaise from the bowl, and without washing the food processor, add some fresh tuna, some scallions, a little onion, and chop them. Not too fine, you don't want it to be mush. Then you make it into patties. Cook it in the skillet for about 2 minutes, turn it for about 2 minutes. You don't want to overcook that tuna, it'll be dry. Place it on the bottom half of a burger bun. Then add some tomato slices, some lettuce, and then I spread the jalapeno mayonnaise on the top of the bun and close it up and just eat it.
That sounds pretty good.
It's very good and very simple. The complete recipe and a photo. That's at dinnerandminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, are we drinking today?
Yes, we are, as always.
Why would I ask you?
I understand that FIU is researching the effects of climate change on winemaking, which is becoming a very hot topic these days. And I've written in the past that the National Academy of Sciences says that by 2050, some of the world's top grape growing areas, California, Spain, Bordeaux, Tuscany, may be too hot and dry to grow good grapes. Is this what you're finding?
That's absolutely what we're finding. We have a partnership with the University of La Rioja in northern Spain, and that's one of the things that we're looking into is taking topography maps with NASA, and we're superimposing what's happening in the movements of growing conditions, and we're seeing that there is a major move forward to the northern parts of the world, and that's happening not just in Europe, but here in the United States. We're seeing many wineries and vineyards that were more toward the southern part of California moving north, and you'll see a greater proportion of those moving into Oregon and Washington, even some even into British Columbia.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Spain, because in that area, Bodegas Torres, one of the country's actually biggest wine producer, already is doing that. It's abandoning some of its seaside vineyards and moving up into the mountains. And people are worried about this, I guess, because it may create a demand for cutting down forests in order to replant grapevines and that sort of thing.
Well, that's a good point, Fred, because it's not just the wine industry and winemakers that are concerned about this kind of situation and they're taking these actions. The same is true in the coffee industry. They have the same problem with cacao production. So it is something that's going to be a big concern for all of us moving forward.
You know, I guess it's not all bad news. I've read that England today has more than 400 wineries, which is a huge jump from 20 years ago. And there's one French grower that I came across who gave up his vineyard in the Loire Valley in the cool area of France that's getting warmer and planted a new one in England.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, because we're going to find wine coming from places we never even thought of before.
Who would drink wine from England, right?
To go along with English food.
The comedian Peter Ustinov once said, "I imagine hell like this, Italian punctuality, German humor, and English wine."
Well, they're going to have to change that, I guess, huh, Fred?
Well, it probably goes well with English food, though, don't you think, Linda?
I don't want to get into big time trouble here, but I have to tell you, there's some good food in England, okay?
I know. I'm just trying to get your goat.
Oh, what a surprise.
Well, then I also hear that FIU is doing some groundbreaking research into a cancer-causing toxin called, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, ochre toxin that's sometimes found in wine. It's not regulated in the U.S. right now. I had not heard about this. Dean, can you tell us more about that?
Fred, it's an important research project. In fact, the USDA has a $5 million grant that's out that includes University of California, Davis, and FIU to study the effects of global warming on wine production. And something that they found is that in winemaking, as the grapes grow on the wine, on the vines, the propensity for mold to grow inside the grape clusters, it increases with global warming. And that mold, if it gets into the juice whenever they're making the wine, can cause these toxins. And we're looking at developing a yeast that will mitigate those toxins, which could cause cancer.
How prevalent is that? Is that that toxin all over the place?
It is around the world. It's a big issue.
Before we go any further, I want to have everybody realize that they're not going to get cancer from drinking wine.
No.
Or are you saying they are?
No. There are incidences from the ochre toxin if it happens to be in the wine. And so that's what we want to do.
You're saying it is in the wine. That's what you're saying.
It can be.
I mean, how do we know if it is or it isn't? We don't.
That's a good question. Yeah, we don't.
I understand.
You're just going to kill the wine industry right now.
Go ahead.
There we go. Yeah. No, well, what we're doing is being proactive, because if global warming increases and the chances for ochre toxin being in wine increases, we want to be able to take the first steps to make sure that it doesn't happen. So that's what we're doing.
I understand that Europe is ahead of us on this. Have they found some ways to combat it, or do you have any leads?
Well, there's a lot of controversy and a lot of discussion about this. In Europe, they use old world winemaking technologies and methods. What we have in the United States tends to be much more advanced. So our sanitation and reduction of molds and bacteria in the winemaking process is much more sophisticated. So the likelihood that they're in American wines is probably less than what you might experience in other locations.
Is this detectable? Can you filter it out or something?
Well, we're expecting that the yeast are going to eat it and get rid of it before it ever becomes an issue.
Oh, interesting.
So, shall we have a glass of wine now or what? Have you killed
it? I can't give up wine.
You know, I'm thinking it's interesting because mold is so helpful. Certain types of mold are beneficial.
Right.
Penicillin.
Well, penicillin
sure.
is
right.
mold, sure.
So, but this is toxic mold.
It could be. That's
it
right.
It could be.
It
okay.
could be, yeah.
What?
So that's why we're doing the research on it, is to determine how prevalent is it and what can we do to mitigate it.
And you're believing that a certain kind of yeast can eat it up and take care of it?
Absolutely. We think that we can develop a unique strain that will be able to deal with it.
That's good news.
All right.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, okay, Fred, so you'll still drink, I'm sure.
I don't have to put down the glass of wine I have in my left.
Exactly. Well, Dean Hampton, much of the important innovation that you're doing that has been financed by the South Beach Wine and Food Festival enables you to do all of this research.
Absolutely. We're very, very fortunate to have had such a long relationship with Southern Wine and Spirits and with the Chaplin family. And we are so much in gratitude to Lee Schrager for his conceptualization of South Beach and what he's done there.
Right. It's just one question. How do you get a ticket?
You know, if you can figure that out, would you let me know also?
Okay, yeah. All right, I will.
Right. Well, in addition to that, the students there help with the demonstrations, and it's a two-way street because then they get to interact with what the events and what's happening. So a lot happens there with it. Well, it's been really fascinating, Dean Hampton. Very interesting week. Mike Hampton, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And congratulations on the continued expansion and the success of the Chaplin School. And it's the Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. Did I get it straight that way?
Absolutely.
Yes? Okay.
You're
at FIU.
Talking.
It's a busy week for you and for the FIU students participating in the festival. Fred Tasker, great advice or questions this time, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Great. Stay warm up there in Michigan.
Oh, we will. It's almost 40 degrees here today.
Oh, summer there.
A heat wave.
Right. Mm-hmm. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, great to be with you.
Always a pleasure, as Fred says.
Well, next week we'll be talking with Dr. Stephen Masley about new information to help prevent and treat heart disease. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps us up. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads of programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Another of our live studio concerts. This time, it's live jazz. Monday, we come back with popular economist Tim Harford. His latest is The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy. The Tuna Burger is at dinnerandminutes.com. An all-Florida calendar for today. On this day, 1927, 87 years ago, the birth in Miami of the first black to win Best Actor at the Academy Awards, Sidney Poitier. Of Bahamian descent, he was born in Coconut Grove. And on this day in 1962, 52 years ago, astronaut John Glenn is launched from Cape Canaveral aboard Friendship 7, the first American to orbit the Earth. He served in the U.S. Senate for 26 years and returned to space at age 77 aboard the space shuttle. Of the famed Mercury 7, he's the only survivor. Carpenter died last year. And now to the bullpen. On this day in 1993, 21 years ago, the Florida Marlins opened their first spring training camp in Brevard County. The opening day starter, of course, and winning pitcher was 45-year-old Charlie Huff. And where are you now, Junior Felix? A nation turns its lonely eyes to you. And we leave with a thought from John Glenn, quote, I don't know what you could say about a day in which you have seen four beautiful sunsets. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.